I'm Dr. Kelly Brogan. You may know me as a New York Times bestselling author of a book with an exploding pill on the cover, renegade psychiatrist, pole dancer, or honorary member of the Disinformation Dozen. What can I say? I'm a born provocateur. I've spent most of my recent life exposing deceptions, connecting dots, and discovering the secret places my inner victim is still waiting to be liberated. And now, I feel called to help you reclaim all of your parts, your health, your sexuality, your power, and your expression, so that you can finally truly own yourself. I want to ignite in you that inner knowing and the pulsing vitality that lives beneath your disempowerment, disconnection, and resentment, so that you can audaciously, courageously, and playfully alchemize your struggle into the specific pleasure of who you are. This is Reclamation Radio.
Hi, and welcome back to Reclamation Radio. I am Dr. Kelly Brogan, and I am here with Dr. Daniel Reuters to talk about his extraordinary book, which is amazingly, and I know there was some like backstory to how you chose this title ultimately and Socratically, but which is called Can You Catch a Cold? So he is a clinician and an ally, and I want to make sure that everybody listening is aware that there is a resource that now exists to support your intuition around the body's wisdom, and specifically when it comes to, I think, one of the most, and I'm sure you would agree, penetrative, you know, memes, let's say, penetrative thought viruses that exists collectively, which is that you can be exposed to an invisible particle, or I guess more, you know, materially, the fluids of a sick person, and you can have an experience of your body that you wouldn't otherwise have. So before we dive in, I just wanted to share one of the first times that I was opened up, you know, to this idea that perhaps germs don't cause disease was when I was talking to my then mentor, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, and he was telling me about something I've never heard about before or since, which is called Keshen's disease, right? And so you have several examples in the book, like pellagra and scurvy, of these assumed to be contagious phenomenon that ultimately turned out to be nutritional, right? So in this particular instance, it was like a province in China that was experiencing a seeming epidemic of cardiomyopathy. And, you know, there was even the thought to deploy pharmaceutical interventions in injectable form because of the assumption that this was contagious. And when there was further investigation of some like epidemiologic anomalies, they found that in the places where people had the symptoms, they had specifically like selenium depleted soil. And so clearly this was, you know, proximity was not causality. And that was one of the first times I thought, oh my gosh, the danger of assumptions, right? The danger of assumptions. And perhaps it's all, you know, by design and a reflection of deeper layers of consciousness that I think we'll get to unpack in this hour. So first of all, welcome. And second of all, I'm really interested in your initial aha moments around this subject and to know, you know, what started this snowball, you know, tumbling down the mountain that turned into like over 1,000 references that, you know, in my opinion, it would be impossible to resolve the cognitive dissonance that you would have reading this book and remaining with the conclusion that there is such a phenomenon called contagion and such a specific enemy out there called a germ. So I'd love to just hear a little bit about your story, making the shift into, you know, this perspective.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me, Kelly. I'm really excited to speak with you and looking forward to the conversation that we're going to have this evening. I was first exposed to this idea that germs may not cause disease in my undergraduate degree. So 2006, 2007, I was introduced to this for the first time. And I immediately dismissed it because I thought, I'm here to learn science, paying a lot of money for my degree and learn the real stuff. I don't want this pseudoscience thrown at me. And they taught us in the degree at that time about terrain theory. So all the things that we're talking about now, they taught us back then, and I threw it out. Not entirely. I approached the way that I practiced after I graduated with a dualistic perspective that there are germs that can make you sick, but if your terrain is healthy enough, if your immune system's functioning well, and you're doing all the right things to support your immune system, you can be exposed to any germ and you won't get sick. And then in early 2020, I heard Dr. Tom Cowan and Dr. Andy Kaufman and doctors like yourself following them, and Drs. Sam and Mark Bailey as well, a little bit later, talking about the same idea. And I thought, there's got to be something to this. I've heard about this before. And my position at that time, I was a senior lecturer at a university. I'm no longer working there for various reasons, but I knew that as a part of my position, giving public talks and presentations and lectures, that this topic would come up. So I knew that I had to look into it and get enough information so that I could answer people's questions confidently. So I decided to start at the beginning. Thought, I'm just going to go back to when germ theory first came about and even before then, and just started amassing a repository of information. And Roman Bistrianic, who's the co-author of Dissolving Illusions, which is a fantastic book, he caught wind of this and contacted me and said, look, man, you've got to put all this stuff into a book. You've got so many references and experiments there that disprove this idea of contagion. And I originally thought I was just going to put it into a little booklet that would take me a couple of months to write. And 4 years later, early this year, 2024 in March, I published the book. So after 4 years of work and reading hundreds and thousands of papers and working with a team of fantastic scientists and doctors and virologists and a microbiologist and a psychologist as well, because there's a lot of psychology involved in this book, we published a book which I think really challenges this long-held belief about contagion and certainly gives people who are on the fence or even who dismiss this idea something to think about.
How easy was it for you to access these references? Because when I was in my, 10,000-hour rabbit hole around the subject of infectious disease, it was back in probably, it started, I would say, back in 2009. And I had, PubMed open to me, and I could search various pre-existing, websites and databases. And it was just a matter of taking the time, honestly. Everything was available. And obviously, since then, sometimes I even think with my daughters, I'm like, if they wanted to even, look up something on Google these days, and particularly since, probably 2018 and 19 with algorithmic changes, they literally wouldn't be exposed to these resources. They wouldn't come up. Probably they'd be deeply buried on page 20 of the search results. So how easy was it to come upon, especially historical information? Or did you have to like bob and weave through censorship gates?
Yeah, it's not easy to find that information. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is for it to be a reference book, basically a textbook written in a way that's entertaining enough for people so they don't get bored out of their mind. But that's essentially what it is. It's a textbook. It's a reference book with all those experiments there for people to access readily. Some of these references were incredibly difficult to find, even the major ones. Like a lot of people talk about the Rosenau studies, which are the ones done by the US Department of Health and the US Navy in 1919 with the Spanish flu. Everyone talks about these. And that was incredibly difficult to find the full document. It was like a 120-page document. And if you go into PubMed and look for it, it doesn't show up. And if you really dig in PubMed, you'll find one part of it, but you won't find the other two-thirds. So for me to find the full text took me weeks, like literally 8 hours a day. I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm looking, and you eventually find it. And you go, great, now I've got this. And then you'll read some of what they're saying and they'll mention another author's name or they'll mention another experiment. Go, right, well, now I need to go and find this one. So all I've got now to work with is a surname and a date And now I'm trawling through the literature trying to find this stuff. And sometimes it's in German, sometimes it's in Spanish and French. I mean, it's just incredibly time consuming to find this stuff. So yes, there are 1,000+ references in there. And I probably could have wrote it in a much shorter time span. But much of that time, much of that 4 years was spent hunting down information. And, you know, Kelly, I'm not surprised that it's not readily available, because if it was, I think people would ask some pretty important questions around this idea of contagion. Certainly doctors would, when they're going through their training, and no one gets exposed to this stuff. So even if they went looking for it, they would find nothing. So they would just, the feeling and the thought of trying to investigate further would pass. It's like, oh, it's too hard to find anything. I'll just let it go. And you go about your career never to think of it again. So hopefully this book does what it set out to do, is to be a reference material for the general public and for medical and health professionals alike.
So you talk about the untold story that clearly you have unearthed through these Herculean efforts you've made over these 4 years. And part of the untold story that you document is that there were so-called anti-contagionists in history, right? So if we assume that the dominant narrative that we're fed by, you know, culture and health mandates and colloquial phrases and all that stuff today is, you know, it's just sort of like arose, like we developed the knowledge and now here is the knowledge, right? It tells a very different story than what you have exposed. So I wonder if you could give a couple of the teaser highlights of this, you know, historical, you know, sort of dualism around this idea that either contagion is something to worry about as a human being, or it's actually, there's nothing to see here. There's nothing to worry about, because I don't imagine that many people would know that there were discussions about what so many of our colleagues are coming to understand about the nature of the human body and our relationship to microbes today, right? Like we're digging up, most of us, you know, some of these older concepts that already have existed. We're not coming up with new ones necessarily to help understand, you know, these relationships. So yeah, could you share a little bit about that for people who've never heard of what the hell I was just talking about for the past, you know, couple of minutes?
Sure. We're under the assumption that germ theory manifested itself after years and years and years of trial and error and doctors accruing information. And we eventually had an accumulation of sufficient evidence to suggest that, hey, maybe germs cause disease. And then we have Pasteur come along and he does some of the final scientific experiments to prove for sure that our assumptions and all of this accumulated evidence are factual. And now we've proven it. That's it. No more questions. It's all good. That's not the way it happened. They were about to throw out germ theory. When I say they, the medical profession. So we're talking mid-1800s. They were on the cusp. They were on the cusp of throwing out this idea of contagion, because they had disproven so many illnesses that they thought were contagious and showed that they weren't contagious, like yellow fever, for example. They thought forever that it was certainly contagious. They showed that it wasn't. And that was one of the final nails in the coffin for this idea of contagion. Once they demonstrated this, the 95% of the medical profession in the United Kingdom, at least, and I would say probably the similar percentage in the United States around that time, were all in agreement that there was no contagion. The overwhelming majority of doctors thought this. And just as they were about to throw it out, Pasteur comes along and puts out some experiments, which he says demonstrated that germs cause disease. And we hear this story about his swan flask experiments and these various other things that he did, traveling up the Pyrenees Mountains and doing all sorts of things with various flasks and exposing it to air and showing that germs exist in the atmosphere and yada, yada, yada. And that flimsy evidence, it wasn't really even evidence, that flimsy story that he told was then propped up and used as evidence to support this idea that germs cause disease. Without any human experimentation, it was basically just some lab work being done. And that lifeline was then clasped very tightly by this 5 to 10% of the medical profession. And basically then slowly implemented into medical education over the next 30 to 40 years. And the medical profession were very reluctant to accept this idea. They weren't embracing germ theory with open arms. It took decades and decades and decades for medical doctors, particularly in the United States, to accept the idea that germs cause disease and that disease is contagious. Most of these doctors were, as you said, they were sanitarian doctors, and they believed that it was the environment that dictated your health. So it was the quality of the food you ate, the water that you drank, the quality of the air, the type of work that you did, sanitary conditions, whether or not you have access to clean water, and are you living in your own filth, and these kinds of things. So they understood back then that they were the key factors that determined whether or not someone was healthy or sick. The germ, even if it existed, was inconsequential to them. And then you had the Flexner Report in 1913, which was basically the death knell for this way of thinking. It was ousted, it was blacklisted, and colleges weren't allowed to teach this sort of sanitary method or understanding of medicine. And even meteorological medicine, that entire field's cast by the wayside around that same time when the Flexner Report was released. And the rest is history. The rest just unfolded naturally. We had the acceptance of mainstream medicine, and it developed over time under this faulty premise. And here we are today, now believing that there's things floating through the air that can make people sick. And I just want to say, I don't know categorically if germs do or do not cause disease. I've been searching for evidence to suggest that germs cause illness. And so far, I haven't been able to find any. It's not to say that it doesn't exist. It may be out there, but I personally haven't been able to find any, and neither have any of the people who helped me work on this book. We've been searching for a very long time, and I know that you probably have as well. This should be some of the easiest evidence to find. It shouldn't be hard, yet it's either not there or it's hidden somewhere in the annals of medicine and forgotten to time. So yeah, I don't know either way. I can't say 100% for certain, but I'm certainly leaning towards this idea that it's probably, as Basham said, the terrain is everything. And then on his deathbed, Pasteur said, you're right, the terrain is everything. The germ is nothing.
You know, you and I know that the burden of proof is on the positive assertion, right? So if somebody's going to introduce a new idea and challenge the pre-existing consensus, then that is what requires the proof. So as you're saying, where is it? Right? Like, where is it? You've been searching high and low. And of course, you know, conspiracy, you know, realist that I am, for me, the story that you tell has many well-positioned characters who seem to have organically emerged, you know, from the populace, and also a very clear agenda that at a certain point clutches the dominant narrative. And, you know, as somebody who's also very dedicated to smoking out victim consciousness wherever it may lie, of course, it lies in that story I just told. So I prefer to believe that all of this is unfolding in perfect design, right? So there is, you know, even in this character, Pasteur, right? And in this deathbed disclosure that most of us have heard of, right? That he sort of admits that everything he, you know, was responsible for propagating was potentially not actually true. That is very common, right? That the truth is in plain sight, right? That that even the purveyors of the myths and deception themselves also disclose the truth, right? Like there's a little cosmic wink. And so I see a lot of that in this story. And I love having learned from your book more about, you know, this pre-existing consensus, because, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but we're grabbing a lot of the gems and pearls from those conversations that were happening between researchers and clinicians, you know, back in the day. So, you know, when we talk about germ theory, first of all, gotta love that the theory part is always in there. When we talk about that, we're talking about germs in general. And I like to think, you know, I pay attention to media and the way that, you know, these colloquial conversations are happening. But when people talk, they're not really necessarily specifically focusing on different microbes, right? Or germs, or what does that mean? Is it bacteria? Is it virus? Is it fungus? We use this term infection as like a blanket explanation for the body being invaded by something that it's dealing with, right? Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered with regard to the way that, let's say, bacteria and viruses are treated differently in your research and where you have arrived in a nutshell, which is where so many of us have, you know, when it comes to specifically the virus conversation? Because most of the book, I mean, the book could be, you know, 10,000 pages about at this level of research about every single infectious disease ever. But most of it is about, you know, the cold and flu viruses, right? So give us a little bit of a primer on how we might consider thinking about these different germs.
Yeah, it's a very relevant topic. The cold and flu issue, if flus are contagious or not. And I really wanted to focus and hone in on that concept and challenge that idea with this book. I actually had another 50,000 words on other illnesses. So I looked at scarlet fever, mumps, chickenpox, various other illnesses as well. But I decided, no, I'm going to remove that. And there's like a whole other book there actually that I could publish, and all similar results with those experiments in relation to the negative findings to do with contagion. But for simplicity's sake, I wanted to remove all that and just focus on the cold and flu. But when it comes to things like bacteria and parasites and fungi and just germs in general, we typically see this idea, I think, was really promulgated by anti-contagionists back in the mid to late 1800s because they thought the body was sterile. So that's where some of this issue has arisen from, is this concept that the body was clean, that there were no germs that lived on you or in you. And if you found a germ and someone was sick, well, the germ must have been the problem. So we hear this analogy all the time. You don't blame the fireman for the fire. You don't blame the detectives for the crime. You know, you don't blame the flies for the horse poo or the cow poo. So we see bacteria and parasites and fungi at the site of damaged tissue, but it doesn't necessarily mean they were the cause of the problem. And again, the anti-contagionists understood that they were that germs were the consequence of disease, not the cause of disease, 150 years ago. They knew this, that the tissue damage happened first, and then all the microorganisms that exist within you come along. They are you. Like, we think of bacteria as separate to us, or parasites as separate to us, or fungi and things as separate to us, but they are us. These microorganisms are as much of a part of us as our white blood cells are. It's just that our white blood cells are internal and the other microorganisms are external to us. So they exist in the mucous membranes of the body, like in the lung, in the mucous membranes of the eye, in the reproductive tract, on our skin. So they're the interface between the external world and our body. They allow us to interface with the world around us. So when some of that tissue becomes damaged, the mucous membranes or the skin that's exposed to the external world, then those microorganisms proliferate and clean up the mess. So of course, if you find some damaged tissue there, you're going to find germs. They attempted to cause illness. Like, doctors attempted to cause illness by introducing these things, even parasites, into healthy people. Nothing happened. Nothing ever happened. So what they had to resort to, say staph, for example, when they put it into, like, onto people's skin, it did nothing. later on, they found that staph was just a normal commensal part of the human microbiome. But originally, they didn't realize that. They thought it was only there in disease states. So they put it onto people's skin, nothing happened. So then what they did was they started getting sandpaper and like a cheese grater and grating up people's skin and then coming and lathering massive quantities or even taking needles and injecting this stuff subcutaneously underneath the skin, underneath this damaged skin. And then an infection would happen and would get all red and inflamed and pussy and all sort of stuff. They go, ah, see, bacteria does cause illness. But they could only do that after the tissue had been damaged. And now there's evidence that has come out in recent decades, even in the 80s, they were looking at this, showing that things like staph actually produce substances that help to heal damaged skin. Right? So it's not the bacteria's fault. The bacteria are you. You don't look at someone with cirrhosis of the liver from abusing alcohol for 20 years. And you take a biopsy of their liver and you see all this scar tissue and some macrophages and other white blood cells in the liver tissue and go, oh, must be the white blood cells causing the problem. No one does that. That's crazy to think that your white blood cells would be doing that. It was the alcohol's problem, right? So the alcohol damaged the liver, then the body responded. Same with germs. We have to look at the cause of the problem. What is the thing that damaged the tissue first? That is where our attention should lie. And then the germ is inconsequential. It is just there doing the job. Stop focusing on the firemen. Stop focusing on the detectives at the scene of the crime. Stop focusing on the flies, on the horse poo or whatever it is. They are the consequence. They are not the cause.
So everyone's taking CMOS, and I am feeling this trend because I love fortifying my food with food rather than supplements in capsules. So in case you don't know, CMOS is a natural gel that has over 90 bioavailable minerals and vitamins, and it's a natural prebiotic. I personally love Samadhi CMOS, which is a super transparent company that I trust, and they serve up raw wild sea moss that is never harvested from rope, which is apparently a thing. And they have 9 different flavors, including tonic herb and medicinal mushroom infused blends with shilajit and their fruit blends. They all are super palatable. I take a tablespoon or two a day and I wash it down, like the whole tablespoon I just washed down with lemon water, and it is 100% not gross. So that's essential for me because otherwise I'm just not going to comply. They don't have any preservatives, thickeners, artificial ingredients. And I noticed a shift within 1 week, specifically in my digestion. So I'm really pumped about it. They are offering y'all 10% off with the code KELLY10. So check out the link in show notes. I wonder what you can explain to folks, because it's almost like I can feel a percolating question, which is, okay, so if that's true, we're talking about bacteria, and I'm thinking about like a urinary tract infection or a skin infection or, you know, this kind of sinusitis or whatever, why would an antibiotic work then? Right. And we're going to talk in a little bit about the role of psychology and placebo effect, my favorite subject. So we don't have to necessarily touch on that. But if there is a physiologic impact, like when I researched this, I found evidence that, you know, antibiotics have a direct impact on stress physiology, right? And on cortisol secretion. And so they sometimes can just be like a kick in the adrenals that suppresses the expression of symptoms. But I wonder what you would say to folks who say, okay, but why would an antibiotic work if the bacteria aren't the problem? And the antibiotic is, as we like to imagine, it's this specific. The antibiotic is just killing all the bacteria. Why would I ever get better then?
Yeah, you can't look at the treatment. You can't look at the effect of a treatment and then garner any information or any insight as to the cause of the problem. Oh, I took a paracetamol when I had a headache. Oh, well, therefore you must have had a paracetamol deficiency, right? No, that's not how it works. You can't work backwards from this. You have to work forwards. You have to find out what was the reason why you got the infection, which is actually the healing response in the first place. So I think the reason why this is so difficult for people to understand is because they're confused about what disease actually is and what symptoms actually are and what signs actually are. It's the healing response. Disease is the healing response.
Yeah, pit against our bodies psycho-emotionally from our early childhoods, it's very easy for us to collude with the rejection of our bodies, right? That says like, these symptoms feel bad, so I must, you know, get on the team that says these symptoms are bad and we can suppress them through these different avenues, right? So, because if you stay on your own team, then you would always be curious about what the symptoms are trying to tell you about your lived experience, right? Whether that's an exposure or, you know, a dynamic or a habit in your life. But it's really that, it's that fulcrum that says like, are you with you or are you with us? Right? And the us is usually deeply invested in this idea that your symptoms are the problem. Your body is the problem, right? Like let's manage that. So I just love meeting folks who have come to such similar conclusions and through the bridge of science, right? So you have all of this amassed to support this more beautiful truth that feels so much better to believe. So, okay. So we're talking about, you know, bacteria. You touched on this idea of parasites and fungus. What about viruses, because obviously the, you know, sort of zeitgeist of awareness around this concept of viruses, which is philosophically and metaphysically even more interesting because they aren't, you know, grossly visible, right? According to the dominant narrative, the way that bacteria and fungus and parasites are, right? Just pop a slide under a microscope. So now we're talking about something, an even more elusive enemy. And, you know, I wonder if you can summarize a lot of what these 200 experiments, you know, really found when it comes to viruses. And of course, the conclusion that you and so many of us have come to about whether or not they actually even exist.
Yeah, it's an interesting and important topic that I think deserves a lot of discussion. Before doctors assumed that viruses caused illness, the cold and flu, they were under the assumption that bacteria were the cause because they found the bacteria, Pfeiffer's bacillus, in the respiratory tracts of sick people. And after failing to make healthy people sick by exposing them to this bacteria and finding this bacteria in healthy people, despite holding on to this idea for three decades, they finally let it go and said, right, it can't be the bacteria. Can't be. There's too many pieces of information that conflict with this idea and this theory. So they had to let it go and they had to replace it with something because now they were wedded to this idea that it must be a germ. And they thought, well, there's got to be something smaller. So let's call it a virus. And they looked and they looked and they couldn't find anything. They had nothing tangible to work with. And then maybe in the 20s or 30s, there was a gentleman, I can't remember his name now, but he basically gave a definition of what a virus was because it was really hard for the medical profession in the field of virology to advance forward because they never saw a virus. They had no idea what it was. They had nothing to really work with and go forward with. And he provided a definition of what a virus was and allowed the field of virology to basically be born and then blossom into this field of medicine that we have today. And he defined a virus. He said that a virus is a virus because a virus is a virus. Like he literally said this, right? And everyone went, ah, awesome, great. Okay, now we know what a virus is. Now we can start tackling this problem. So they never saw a virus in the bodily fluids of a sick person. They were using logical fallacies and circular reasoning to define what viruses were. And then they were doing experiments to create the effect that they were looking for. So they were essentially poisoning cells in culture flasks and finding debris and pointing to pieces of cellular breakdown and saying that's the virus, but never controlled for their results or their experiments. They never dealt with these problems. There's all these confounding variables as to, you know, other things that might be causing the effect that they're looking for, but their controls were never done. And despite all of this, they continued to accept this idea that it must be a virus. So here we are today with what I think is scientists creating substances that don't exist in nature in a lab. They're poisoning and starving cells in a completely unnatural way, getting an effect and then using that effect to prop up this idea that what they're seeing is a virus. Never taking those particles and exposing them to healthy people and seeing if they cause disease. They've never done that. I don't think they can do that because if they do, it'll show that nothing happens. And even like more simply than that is the idea of contagion. So it's like these things exist in your body fluid, even though we can't see them, they're there. But then when they take the body fluid and expose it to healthy people, it does nothing. Nothing happens. So there's so many things wrong with this theory that just don't hold up to scrutiny. And rather than science and medicine going, right, maybe we got it wrong, let's see if we can reevaluate here and course correct. They just defend and defend and get on the front foot and they go on the attack and say, we don't know what we're talking about and the evidence is there and it's well-established and all these kinds of things. But never once do they provide the evidence to substantiate that these things actually exist and cause illness. So they're trapped in this paradigm now and they can't escape it because if they were to ever come out and say, hey, we got it wrong, it would be irreconcilable. They could not undo all of the damage that this theory has caused humanity and the environment over the last 100 and whatever years. There's not enough money in the world. There's not enough ways in which they could undo this damage. So they'll never admit it. So I don't know what the outcome is there, whether there's going to be two sort of coexisting thought patterns amongst health practitioners and patients, or if there's going to be another outcome that, I mean, we could speculate as to what might happen. But all we can do is just highlight these issues and let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, that's why I've always loved that Bucky Fuller quote about, you know, fighting the existing system, which I attempted to do for a decade of my, you know, career activism versus building a new one that renders it obsolete. I mean, that is the reclamation of your energy, right? So even the tone and the feeling of your book is, to me, it's not like approving, like, I will prove to you, bad daddy, that you wronged me. You know, it's really just sort of, it's almost delightful. It's almost just sort of like, wow, look at all of this. You know, like there's 200 experiments. And, you know, first of all, there's no randomized trials, and they've never, ever, one time ever proven this thing we've all been, you know, colonized by, this concept. And what's interesting to me is that I see the same, and I'm sure many people do, the same dynamics in other tropes, right? In other theories, right? So my first sacred cow was the monoamine hypothesis or the serotonin theory of depression. And when I went and looked, you know, and also there were others, you know, who there were forefathers and mothers who had been looking already for many years. You know, there were at the time, there was six decades of efforting to prove this theory, right? It's like the theory was posited, and then there's like a scramble over many years to look in, you know, cerebrospinal fluid and quote unquote genes, and looking at serotonin depletion studies and looking what happens with that when a healthy person is, and not one, there's not a shred. It's the same story. And somehow, you know, we still are watching commercials about how Zoloft is going to cure your chemical imbalance. So if that theory fits with where you're at in your, you know, psycho-emotional or spiritual development, it's going to be comforting, right? It's going to feel better to believe that you are indeed broken. And there is this evidence that says, you know, there's nothing you can do. It's like reifying the powerlessness is actually familiar. But what gets me, and I know you too, like, it's like, on a scientific conversational level, on an academic level, we know that the methods matter, right? Like when you read a paper, you don't just read the conclusion. It's like the methods matter. Every clinician and scientist knows that. And yet these methods still say, you know, still make presumptive statements like, you know, in this case, the virus was purified, right? Like, well, and then somebody, a lay person might say, well, look at this paper. It says the virus was purified. What are you talking about? You're saying that hasn't happened. Look, it says it right here. It has happened. And so it's like this hand waving and smoke and mirrors that perpetuates it. But even in the very community that has pledged allegiance to the scientific method, like we all agreed, this is what the scientific method looks like. This is the game we're playing. So how come, you know, you're allowed to play dirty like this and not adhere to your own methodology? Like, how is this happening? So I'd love to just talk briefly, and I know this is a huge subject in your book, about these postulates, right? Like about this agreement that we all made in the medical and scientific community around Koch's or Ribber's postulates to say, okay, this is how we'll know that there's a causal agent here. And like, what happened that nobody is actually adhering to these in the academic world? Like, certainly I'm not in the business of debating academicians about, you know, why they still believe what they believe. I think there's no point in that. But it's just sort of like, this is so funny. Like, this is really funny that we're in this position. So what is it that we have agreed? And what do you think, you know, scientists in the mainstream are saying about those agreements as they choose to not adhere to them, right, in the conversation about germ theory?
This isn't just even for germ theory. I think this is for science as a whole. I'm not even sure that if you go and study a science degree, they actually even teach you what the actual scientific method is. And if you go and look in the internet for the scientific, like what is science, it's so unclear, even though science is a method. It's a very simple set of steps that should be followed. And when they are followed, logically and sequentially, it demonstrates a cause and effect relationship between X and Y. I'm not sure that's actually being taught in science degrees anymore. I think they're getting all this other fluff to draw attention away from this method. And we see this all the time when we're saying to scientists and doctors, hey, they didn't follow the scientific method here. They're like, what are you talking about? The scientific method is blah, 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 blah. It's all these things. It's like, no. That's not what the scientific method is. Here it is, and they haven't followed it. And they start getting defensive, and there's all these logical fallacies getting thrown around. Essentially, Robert Koch devised a, well, actually, he didn't even devise Koch's postulates. He ripped them off someone else.
So much drama.
Everyone points to Koch as this brilliant guy, this brilliant mind who created a set of steps to demonstrate that a germ causes illness. And essentially it was, you find the germ in a sick person, only in sick people. You isolate that germ, a pure culture, we're talking about bacteria here. When you have the pure culture, you then expose a healthy person to that bacteria and it will replicate the identical disease. And then you find that bacteria in that sick person and you re-isolate it. Now you've completed the steps. So in theory, that would work if germ theory was correct. Like, I completely agree with those postulates, 100%. However, when Koch set out to demonstrate that germs cause disease using his own postulates, he couldn't do it. No sooner had he created those postulates than he was like, oh, I've got to modify them. And he had to modify them in such a way to be like, well, you don't have to find the germ in only sick people. Like, they'll exist in healthy people. And then he had to create this idea of immunity and all these sort of rescue devices and basically changed his postulates under the assumption that his postulates were incorrect, but the theory was true. So he was trying to chop and change these postulates to fit a broken theory rather than saying, oh, these postulates are actually right. and they're not proving the theory. Therefore, the theory's wrong. He was like, oh no, I've stuffed up somehow. The postulates can't be right because the theory is true. So there's a big disconnect there. And those modified postulates, where now you can find the germ in healthy and sick people, and if you expose people to the germ and they don't get sick, or you find the germ in healthy people repeatedly, well, it's because you're immune, or you've got good genes, or it's because it's a non-pathogenic strain of the particular bacteria. Like, there's all these things that have to now get invented to explain away these inconsistencies and anomalies. When, if you just think about it logically and rationally, maybe it's just because germs don't make you sick. So if they were intellectually honest with themselves back then, they should have thrown it out and gone, no, it's wrong. But I think there were other things going on in the background, behind the scenes, where this theory had to be propped up to act as a scapegoat, possibly act as a scapegoat for the damaging effects of other things that we were being exposed to as a consequence of modernity. So I'm talking about like spraying our food with poison, putting poison in the water supply, breathing polluted air, being detached from nature, the dissolution of the family unit, working 60-hour weeks, being discontent with your life. Like all of these things, right? Now we're all getting sick where we once weren't living that way and people were much healthier. Now we see all this disease coming through. It's like, oh, is it all these things? No, no, no. Don't worry about any of that stuff. It's not the poison. It's not the artificial lighting and the synthetic clothing and the pollution in the air. It's a germ. People go, oh, that explains it. So now we don't deal with the true underlying cause. So I think that's maybe the reason why they had to be intellectually dishonest and say, no, it is the germ, guys, rather than admitting, hey, look, we got it wrong. They weren't acting in good faith for what I believe to be a sort of a red herring, right? It's a scapegoat. It's the old magic trick. Look over here. And meanwhile, there's something else going on behind the scenes.
And the natural extension of that belief system, really your only choices are to experience others as the enemy. So it's the atomizing of the human species, right? Like all of a sudden we start to, you know, suspect that somebody else might be a vector of harm, right? So how do you control that? You avoid other people, or you know, guard yourself, and or you further poison yourself. So you collude with industry and engage pharma, and, you know, you perpetuate exactly, you know, that which is propagating the issue, right? So that's often what we end up doing, this dance, this like whack-a-mole dance of like, oh, I'll suppress it over here, and, you know, something new crops up, some side effect, some unintended consequence, and then you don't connect those dots, and there you become a patient, right? A chronic patient from an acute exposure. So you talked about some of these vectors of what we call illness, right? And this replacement theory fallacy, or whatever you want to refer to it as, where just because, you know, you've compiled the evidence that, in my opinion, incontrovertibly demonstrates that so-called germs do not cause the cold, right? If we want to limit it to that, but I would say illness in general. It's not actually, the burden of proof is not on you to provide the replacement theory, right? So this is what, it's a logical fallacy that so many people engage where you say, well, okay, well, if it's not that, then how do you explain my toddler going to daycare and coming home with the same thing that his little desk neighbor Johnny had? And of course, whenever there are multiple potential explanations, then a rigid and dogmatic theory cannot possibly encompass them all. Like once there's even a few explanations, then, you know, all bets are off. And we don't know for sure. I mean, you have the humility to admit that you can't even necessarily rule out the possibility that, you know, contagion is a driver. It's just that there's no evidence yet. So it's just one of the potential theories that are unfounded, right? What have you understood to be some of the most compelling drivers, if not the definitive explanation, right? Some of the most compelling drivers, and you've referenced some of them already, of what we are calling illness, that you and I agree, is actually the manifested healing response. Like, what have you kind of come to zero in on?
I didn't really mention this in the book, but I have been looking at this in more detail since writing the book. And that is this idea that nature doesn't do disease. So if you look at anthropological and even medical evidence where doctors, teams of doctors, went in to visit uncontacted tribes throughout history, even through the 1800s, early 1900s, even today, they're doing this. There's still some tens of thousands of people living uncontacted in the world, I think a couple of dozen tribes. When anthropologists and doctors and even explorers like the First Fleet in Australia, when they landed here, and the explorers in the Pacific and the Spanish in the New World, they all commented that the natives were free of disease. They were just blown away. No one's got disease. There's no cancer, there's no diabetes, there's no heart disease, there's no obesity, there's no depression, there's no anxiety. I mean, there's nothing. They're all healthy and in peak physical condition. So what that tells us, that gives us a baseline. When you live in harmony with nature, and we are a part of nature, we are not separate to it, there is no disharmony. There is no imbalance. There is no dis-ease. Because what dis-ease is the body or the environment in an active state of returning to balance. So if you drop a rock into some water, it creates ripples. So the rock is the thing that caused the problem. The ripples are the symptom. The ripples are there for the water now to find its level again. And when the water finds balance and homeostasis, there's no more ripples. So the disease goes away. So we have to ask the question, what is the rock? What is the thing that's causing the ripples? We don't blame the ripples for the problem. The ripples are the symptom. The ripples are the answer. Disease is the healing response. So we have the baseline now of when you live in harmony with nature, there's no disease. So what are all the things that we are doing that we're doing now that we weren't doing back then? There's a list as long as your arm. We're spraying our food with poison. We're not eating seasonally. We're not eating locally. We're not growing our own food. We're disconnected from our food supply. We're importing food from thousands of kilometers away. We're processing it. We're adding chemicals into it. We're stripping it of nutrients and re-adding nutrients back in. We're destroying our environment. We're polluting our water supply. We're polluting our air. I mean, I don't want to keep going on here. People get the idea. The answer to all of this is to getting back to basics, to getting back to balance, to let nature have a bit of a chance to restore some balance. Because disease is essentially just a barometer of how sick and dysfunctional a society is. And the Western society is a sick, toxic, dysfunctional society. So we just need to look at what our ancestors are doing, take a feather out of their cap, and realign ourselves with how they lived. I'm not saying we have to go and live back in the dark ages, but we can take some steps that would go a long way to reducing a lot of this burden of chronic disease here. So what are those things? Let's maybe even look at how our ancestors lived 100 years ago, 150 years ago. They were building their houses out of natural building material. They were growing their own food. They were farming regeneratively and sustainably. They had a family unit. They were more connected. Many more people were working on the land. They felt like they had purpose and meaning in their life. But they're spending more time outside. I mean, there's just so many simple things that we take for granted and we go, that possibly couldn't have any effect on my health because it's so simple. And what you mean, like getting out in the sun and breathing some fresh air and just relaxing for a bit is helpful to my health? Yeah, these things are so simple. They're essential to life. But we discount them because they're free and they're easy and they're simple and they're low barrier to entry. We've been conditioned to believe that the only way to become healthy is to go and see someone who's done 10 years of training, specialty training, who's got a prescription pad and a white coat and a scalpel or some fancy equipment. They're the only ones who hold the key to my health. And the opposite is true. You hold the key, you hold the power, and it's about getting back to basics. Like, this is not a secret. we've known this for a long time. It's just that we need to reconnect to this information.
And what would you add about the role of belief and nocebo effect and even phenomena of social contagion that have existed, you know, because the lifestyle practices, I mean, I have a protocol with history making outcomes that is the most basic lifestyle practices. So it doesn't even take that much of a disruption, right, of our exposures to for the body to exhale and say, thank you, right? And, you know, the first, I'd like to joke affectionately that the first 2 weeks of Vital Mind Reset are just brainwashing, right? Like without that front loading of a different way of thinking and, you know, restoring the locus of control within, as you're referencing, you know, a lot of these lifestyle factors may not even have the chance that they would to communicate that signal of safety to the body because of the power of belief that I know, you know, you reference in the book. So I think it's still hard for a lot of folks to appreciate just how powerful fear, let's say, of exposure to germs or others who are sick can be. But this is a well-documented phenomenon, right? So I wonder if you could just share a line or two about what you've concluded is the role of your beliefs and associated fears in actually manifesting the symptoms that we would otherwise see in the setting of detox, you know, that you and I are referencing here.
Yeah, there's placebo-controlled experiments where they've exposed people, healthy people, to saline, told them it was a germ, but gave them saline and they manifested a cold or flu. And they came in the next day after watching them overnight and they said, ha, gotcha. It wasn't a germ, it was salt water. And they got better within 15 minutes. So the power of the mind was sufficient, or is powerful enough to manifest symptoms of a cold or flu. It can manifest any disease. It's powerful enough to make people's hair fall out when they're under the assumption that they're exposed to chemotherapy. It's powerful enough to reverse symptoms of arthritis when people believe they were given a surgery when they weren't. Like there's all kinds of things where people have been given a placebo and their disease went away. So the opposite also works, which is the nocebo. So if you're told that if you come in contact with a sick person from the day you can walk, and people in places of authority or positions of authority tell you this and you believe it, and then one day you come in contact with the sick person and you get sick and you go, ah, what mum and dad and the doctor told me must be true. I must have caught a germ from this other person. You now carry that forward with you for the rest of your life. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And we become conditioned to that. We hold on to it till the day we die. And if people like you and I come along and say, hang on a second, actually, there's all these other reasons why you might be getting sick. And just that mental conditioning alone might be sufficient to play a profound role in disease manifestation. And we need to course correct and challenge the way we're thinking. They go, no, it couldn't possibly be right because this happened to me personally. So it's really hard to undo a lot of that conditioning, but a lot of people understand it. And I think it's just about repetition. Just keep repeating this information and the people that are ready to hear it will get access to it. And those who are willing to look into it further for themselves and possibly integrate some of this information into their own life will benefit from it.
Okay, I have one more point to make on this subject before we wrap up, which is, you know, I come from Italian stock, and there is a passionate belief. While every Italian I know in my family believes in germ theory, there's a passionate belief about the power of air conditioning to make you sick, right? And the role of climate and temperature. And I was like really delighted to see a treatment of that material in your book, because I do think there's some like conflicting internal tropes that a lot of us are culturally raised with. So, you know, what would you say is your, you know, I guess conclusion, if that's too strong a word, on the role of climate and temperature in what many, you know, cultures seem to feel is contributory to the cold and flu, I would say.
Yeah, the cold was named the cold because of the symptoms that people experienced after there was a cold snap or change in temperature. Influenza was called influenza because of the symptoms that people experienced from the influence of the cold. So our ancestors put the answers there for us. It's not a secret. They were trying to tell us the answer. But now we've said, no, when there's a cold, snap and there's a temperature change, more viruses are in the air and it dries out your mucous membranes and then you're more susceptible to catching a virus. But actually, we know that changes in humidity and temperature cause physiological changes in the respiratory tract. And it essentially causes the body to purge. I mean, to put it really simply, you undergo a purge. When there's a change in humidity and temperature below a certain threshold. Now, if you don't need to purge, if you've been taking care of yourself, then you don't purge. You're not immune. There's nothing to be immune against. It's just that the body doesn't now need to purge itself. But if you've been doing all the wrong things and this environmental trigger or signal occurs, well, now you're going to have to purge. You're going to have to pay the price. So that's really what's going on. I think the meteorological effects on respiratory infections are profound. There's considerable evidence to demonstrate this. And they were looking at this idea, the meteorological doctors were looking at this in the 1900s, but that division and profession of medicine really fell by the wayside when the advent of viruses came through. And unfortunately, I think the answers really lie in the information that they had already found 100 whatever years ago, but it's been suppressed. And because it's so simple and it makes so much logical sense, we discount it. Couldn't possibly be that simple that a cold is caused by a cold. Or even in tropical areas where there's less temperature changes in variance in the seasons, it's humidity change. And that's the thing that triggers it. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a huge drop in temperature. It can just be a few percentage point differences in humidity. So I think there's a lot that we can learn by looking at the world around us and studying meteorological changes as well.
So my friend, what is life like when your answer to the question, can you catch a cold, is no? Like, how would you say that the shift that you've made has changed your experience of living life in a human body?
No fear, right? The germ theory keeps you in this world of fear. Oh my God, am I going to go outside and get sick? Is someone going to catch something? You're externalizing the reasons why you get sick. You have less accountability. Now, if I get sick, I know it's on me, right? That I was doing the wrong thing. I was eating the wrong thing. I was thinking the wrong thoughts. I wasn't taking care of my body. I wasn't getting outside and getting enough fresh air or sunlight or, you know, it's on me. I can't say, oh, it was nothing that I was doing. It was a virus. So I have to now take accountability and make sure that I'm practicing what I'm preaching. Yeah. So these simple things that I advocate for, dietary and lifestyle recommendations, which are really simple in theory, but they're not necessarily easy to uphold every single day. Yeah, knowing that disease is earned, not caught, really has, you know, keeps you on your game. You've got to be really staying on top of all this stuff, particularly in this sort of toxic world that we live in, not even just with like pollution and stuff, but also toxic thoughts and all these things that we're bombarded with in the media and all these sort of toxic ideas and whatever else. You really have to stay on top of all that. So, yeah, I don't have any fear anymore. I know that I don't catch anything from anybody else. And if I do get sick, it's my own fault. And it's just my body's way of recovering. It's not a disease that I need to suppress. The symptoms are the answer to the problem. And I thank my body if I get sick. I'm like, I'm sorry that I treated you so badly. And thank you for doing what you need to do to return me to balance. Actually, I love my body when I'm sick, rather than hating my body and going, you're doing something wrong. So there's a big paradigm shift there for me. It may also be experienced by other people, but yeah, I guess I can only really talk for myself. Yeah, I guess that's why I wrote the book, is just to share that information with people so they can get access to it. And then what they choose to do with that information moving forward in their life is really up to them.
Thank you, body. Thank you, Daniel. And thank you for this epic contribution that I feel should be in every family's home library, if not to reinforce the intuitive truth that these bodies are wise and that we are meant to live in connection to one another and the natural world. So I appreciate you so much. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Kelly. I really appreciate it. It was a wonderful experience to finally touch base with you. I've been following your work for quite a many years, and so has my wife. So yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks.